I'm Steve McLeod, and you are listening to Bootstrapped, the podcast for people running bootstrapped software companies. In episode 236, I'm the guest on my own podcast. A year ago, Ben Pages joined my company, Feature Upvote, to be our marketing manager. Now, Ben had questions about the early days of Feature Upvote and how this product came to be. He also wanted to know the origin of my low-stress approach to running a business. We thought, why keep this conversation to ourselves? Why not record it as a podcast interview and share it with you? And that is exactly what we did for this episode.
Hello, everyone. For those who don't know, Steve is the founder and CEO of Feature Upvote, a product feedback tool that he created in 2017. As well as the host of the Bootstrap podcast, which you're currently listening to. Today, Steve joins us to share his own entrepreneurial journey. Steve, welcome to your show.
Thank you. This is a really strange experience to be a guest on my own podcast. It's a pleasure to be here, Ben.
I bet, and it's really nice to be interviewing you, having listened to so many episodes of your podcast. When guests come onto your podcast, you send them sort of a checklist that prepares them for the show to come. And one of the questions you ask them is to be prepared to give a short, snazzy description of who they are and what they do. So may I turn the tables and ask that to you?
Okay. Well, you've already told people who I am. I'll tell you what Feature Upvote is. It's a tool, a SaaS product, a B2B SaaS that lets your customers openly suggest and upvote improvements to your product. Now, that's the short elevator pitch type of thing I memorized in the early days of the product. And even as I say it now, I know it's increasingly inaccurate because I say it's a way for your customers to openly suggest, but actually we allow people to use private boards or they use it internally at organizations. And I'm realizing now that I don't actually have a short, pithy description that reflects what the product exactly is today.
What are you going to do?
That is a good question.
All right, for another episode, I guess. Let's go back to the origin story of how you started Feature Upvote. Do you remember the first time you showed Feature Upvote to people or friends or family? And what was that experience like?
Yeah. Well, the trivial piece of information is that originally it wasn't going to be Feature Upvote. The first name was Feature Up, but I couldn't get the .com name. And my girlfriend who works in the business with me, we brainstormed names, and she actually came up with featureupvote.com, which we picked because we could get the .com name. That was a non-negotiable for me. We had to have a .com domain name. I've heard too many stories of people who start off with some domain name that's a compromise, like getyourname.com or yourname.app or yourname.io. And as they grow a little bit and then they realize they want the .com, now they have to pay like 100,000, half a million to get the domain name they really wanted all along. And I wasn't willing to ever let that happen. On that little aside, I forgot the question. Oh, the first time I showed Feature Upvote to somebody.
That's right.
So I did some mockups using my favorite wireframing tool, Balsamiq, made by Powdy and his team. Regular listeners will know who Powdy is. I had a small team then already working with me on the previous product we had at the time, but they were both away for a week. The two people working with me, one was in Thailand, one was in Morocco, and I used that time as a chance to really put together these wireframes of this new product idea I had. They didn't know about it. And when they came back, I just told them, showed them, oh, this is something I've been working on while you're away. I think it could be a new product. What do you think? Instant, complete enthusiasm for the idea. This was a great first start. Now, they weren't the target audience, though. Like, these people weren't going to buy the product. So then I had to go and find people who might actually use it. But I did that thing you're never supposed to do. I actually started building a little basic version of the product already because that's just what I am as a developer. I want to do straight away. So I had a little basic version working, and I went and talked to every single entrepreneurial software person I knew. If I could meet with them in person, I would. If I had to do it online, I would. And I just talked them through what I was doing and asked them for their feedback. I hadn't read the Mom Test at this point, the book that you might be familiar with that says, if you ask your mom for feedback on what you're doing, she's going to say, that's lovely, dear. You're doing very well. I'm sure you'll be very successful. So I kind of asked people in a way in which they all told me what I wanted to hear. Maybe that was a bit misleading. But I remember one of the people I showed it to, he actually said, oh, when can I buy this? When can I start being a paying customer? He had a company at the time that was doing $500,000 in revenue a year. And I remember that triggering something in my mind that said, hey, if I had a way for somebody to pay, I'd have a paying customer already. It's like, this product, this could work.
It's the ultimate commitment, right? Don't listen to your users, but ask them for commitment. That's the real proof of...
Right. Maybe he was just showing that support, but you know, it was real money he was willing to commit.
I love that. When you started Feature About, you, as you mentioned, you started to scratch your own itch. You needed a tool, but you were completely new to that sort of product. If I recall correctly, before that, you were doing a consumer product that was a desktop app. And now you're going in a brand new field. You're working with large businesses and smaller businesses, but you're going into the B2B sphere doing something that you hadn't really dealt with in the beginning. I'm wondering, what was your mindset going into that project? Was it an experiment that you're willing to give X amount of time to kind of test out and experiment with, or were you all in and determined to make it work?
That's a really good question. I was very scared. I was scared that creating a SaaS product that has to be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, would be a nightmare to keep running. I was scared that people would see me as a fraud. This is the imposter syndrome. Now, at that point, I'd had a successful software business for several years, but because I was moving from consumer to B2B, to businesses, somehow I felt like these would be a more demanding audience and they would somehow see that I didn't really know what I was doing, which was strange because in hindsight, I did know what I was doing, right? I had been running a software company. Then I was listening to a podcast episode where they interviewed somebody who was running a small SaaS product. And he said, like, one night it stopped working just before I went to bed. So I just wrote on Twitter, sorry, the site's down. We'll take a look at it in the morning. And then I went to bed. That's what the guy said on this podcast. And I was a bit stunned thinking, wait, you can do that? And he said like a couple of customers weren't happy about it, but he figured, what can he do late at night, right? He couldn't put much effort into getting it working. He was tired. He didn't have his team weren't available. And that activated this idea in my head that actually other B2B SaaSes sometimes go offline. Even the big ones are sometimes offline. AWS has some downtime occasionally, you know? So perhaps it's okay if I aim for the right audience and I have the right type of product. Maybe it's not the end of the world if the product does have any downtime, and therefore that's something that I can mentally take on and build. It also shaped, this thought shaped very much the product that I was going to build. Because when I had listened to this podcast with the guy who said about his SaaS being down overnight, at that point, I didn't actually have the firm idea of Feature Upvote, but I did know I wanted to try a SaaS product. And I realized that what I wanted was something that wasn't mission critical. I wanted to build something that a customer could cope with if it was offline for a few hours once or twice a year. They might not be happy about it, but it wasn't going to grind their business to a halt. So we use Stripe as our payment processor. If Stripe is offline, businesses lose money. We use Jira as a product management tool. If Jira is offline, product teams can't function. They can't assign tasks to people. If GitHub is offline that we use as our source control, it becomes very hard to use the collaborative nature of GitHub. And I didn't want a tool in that category. I wanted one that clearly the customer's business could still function if we were offline for a few hours.
Which brings me to your work philosophy, or maybe it's life philosophy. But for those who don't know, Steve is very dedicated to keeping Feature Upvote stress-free and simple for both the employees himself and the customers. And this is something, as somebody who works with you, has not seen a lot with entrepreneurs and people who are building SaaS companies. And I'm just wondering if it's something that, have you always been that way, you know, looking for good work-life balance, or is that something that you learn through time? Is it nature or nurture?
I want to make a small correction. It's not no stress. It's not zero stress. It's low stress. This always has to be some amount of stress. And it's easy to confuse the two, like low stress with zero stress. But it's about having the stress that has to happen. For example, you know, to go back to the idea of our site being offline, if that does happen, of course, we still want it to get up working again as fast as possible. That is a source of stress. But people who think their business is failing because it hasn't grown 10% per month each month for the last year, that's a source of stress that doesn't need to exist. Spending all the business funds in growth so that there's no money available for payroll next month unless an important customer renews, that's a source of stress that I don't want and that I avoid. So it's about accepting that some stress has to happen, but making sure that there's a lot of stress that doesn't have to happen and not imposing it on ourselves. So that's just the correction. It was very long-winded. Now, the real question, though, was have I always had this low-stress attitude? And I haven't. I've actually learned from experience that it's very easy to get in a high-stress situation of my own making, and I've also learned that I don't deal with it very well. In the early 2000s, my first attempt at a software business accidentally became a consulting business. I fell into the consulting trap where I was doing some consulting to earn money so I could build the software, and actually the consulting business became its own success, and building the software was a risk, so we did the consulting. And without really wanting a consulting business, I went ahead and grew it. You know, as we got too much work, I'd hire more people, and eventually we were about 10 people. The thing about a consulting business, or maybe the more accurate name would be to call it an agency, a web agency, a very scary thing of that type of business is that you're always just 3 months away from having no work. You're always having to renew your existing customers or find new work. And you're very intensely working for certain customers now, using up all your available time in your business, but that's going to stop at some point. And typically, you don't have a pipeline of work lasting more than a few months ahead. So let's say 3 months. And any time a customer would cancel, I'd be thinking, is that it? Like, am I going to have to lay off all the staff for 3 months? How am I going to find more work? Fortunately, I never had to do that. But the stress became something quite physical in me. I developed this lower back pain, and I didn't know it was stress related, but it was really making my life terrible. It was stopping me from sleeping well. It was making me very grumpy with friends and colleagues. I did many things to try and deal with the lower back pain: better exercise, going to massage, like lying on the floor, making sure I was sitting well, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the one thing that made the back pain go away was when I announced to my business partners that I was leaving the business. I gave them 3 months' notice, and the day I told them, the back pain mysteriously just disappeared. And that's when I made the connection that this was a physical manifestation of my stress. And what did I learn from that? That stress does not make for a good physical situation for me, or too much stress, too much self-imposed stress. So I realized then that if I was going to try a software business again in the future, I had to do it on my terms, in a way that worked for me, knowing that I was not good with that high level of stress.
I don't think anybody is really, and as you say, it could manifest in physical pain, or just, you know, be detrimental to other areas of your life. It's great that you've been able to cultivate that awareness and bring it into your journey moving forward, which a lot of people, I guess, they never learn the lesson. They just follow the pattern that they've always been following. So I really like that you've done that and you've been able to maintain it consistently, even though I'm sure there's been pressures from outside to change your approach and maybe grow faster or maybe try new things that everybody else was on to. Are there any of these kind of trade-offs that you've had to make from external pressures?
So one of the approaches I've taken to keep the stress low is not to aim for fast growth. Even when we were very, very new, I figured that I just wanted to grow by a few percent per month. Now, the early days of a SaaS business are when you're typically growing 10, 20, 30% per month until you get to like five-figure monthly revenue. And even then, I thought, I just want it to be slow. I don't set any deadline from which I have to hit that magical $10,000 monthly recurring revenue point. We get there when we get there. That did create some stress of its own, because when we just had a couple of $1,000s in monthly revenue, that's not a profitable business. That's not a sustainable business. And I already had outgoings. I was already paying for somebody to work with me. Now, I did have the other product, still the consumer product, bringing in money, but I knew that I wanted to end that at some point and sell that off. So basically, Feature Upvote was a money sink for a long time. It was certainly not something I could live off. And I didn't know when that would change. Furthermore, every time I became aware of a new competitor, it would make this thought go in my head. It's like, they're taking your customers. They're the ones who are going to be successful. You can't do it. So it was maybe about 3 month period there when our revenue was just 2,000 or 3,000 euros per month, in which that lower back pain started to manifest itself again. And this time I knew what was happening, right? I knew like this stress happening that I'm creating for myself, I have to deal with it. So a friend who's a generation older than me has a lot of experience running a business. He eventually sold his business to his own employees, actually, when he was ready to retire. And I just told him about this, that for some reason I was getting really stressed, and he knew the right questions to ask. But I think just sharing it with somebody who had a lot more business experience and asking for him to share stories of how he had experienced stress and how he dealt with it just somehow helped a lot. You know that saying, a problem shared is a problem halved? I think that's what was going on here. Just talking to a sympathetic person who had been in the similar situation, although on a much grander scale. I mean, he told me about a time in which some problems outside of his control cost his business $1 million. And then suddenly I thought, why am I worrying so much about a business that's actually pretty healthy for where it's at and looks like it's on the right trajectory?
I want to shift gears a little bit and ask you about Feature Upvote pricing. Feature Upvote currently offers two pricing plans. It's got a standard plan and an enterprise plan. But from my understanding, the enterprise plan wasn't always here, and you kind of had to learn the hard way that we needed one. How did that story go?
We also have our secret bootstrapped plan for anybody who asks. I know you know about that, so I assume you thought it was too top secret. We can't even mention it. But yeah, if somebody asks, we generally give them access to our half-price bootstrap plan. But that's not the question. The question is about the enterprise plan. You know, strangely, yesterday, I just happened to find some of the stuff I wrote about the business in the first year of business. And one of those writings was about my attitude towards pricing. And in this, I actually explicitly wrote it, we're not doing enterprise. I don't want to go down that path. It creates a different business. It creates very long sales cycles. It creates more expectation of having to keep the business running in a particular way. And I forgot that over the years. I gradually, slowly did go enterprise. I think what happened is, as our product became more mature and as our marketing became more sophisticated, we started getting people who are interested to use us as an alternative to User Voice, our big enterprise-only competitor. These were the type of people who needed, for their procurement process, they needed to find three or four products and compare them. It's just the way the business works. You can't just go to your procurement department and say, please buy this product. The procurement department's going to say, well, we want to see the alternatives that you have assessed, et cetera. So as we started matching people's Google searches for a good alternative to User Voice that had certain functionality, we started getting more and more of these people asking for demo calls. And at some point, I just had to acknowledge that, look, these are big companies often willing to pay what User Voice charges, thousands of dollars per month. Perhaps it's time I actually rolled up my sleeves and got my hands dirty in doing this stuff. That's part one of the answer. And part two, So initially our price was $29 per month. You know, now it's about $119 per month on our monthly plan. And some of the first customers were bootstrapped software companies like mine, the original target audience. But as I looked into every single customer we got, you know, in the first days of having your own SaaS, you tend to get excited about every new customer and you go and read up about them. You look at their website. If they're big enough, you read their Wikipedia page. But when we started getting customers who had their own Wikipedia page, that's when I started to think, perhaps $29 a month is not the right price for these customers. So one of the earliest customers we got was Heidelberg Cement. I hadn't heard of them. I looked them up. World's biggest cement manufacturing conglomerate at the time. We got JCB. I hadn't heard of them. I looked them up. Turns out that they're this massive UK-based earth-moving equipment company, a household name in the UK, doing billions of dollars in revenue, billions of pounds in revenue per year with tens of thousands of employees, and they were paying me $29 a month. We got a few customers like this, and at this some point I realized I have to find a way to let these people pay a lot more money if they choose to, which also was part of tying into eventually coming up with the enterprise plan.
So Future of Vote is in Barcelona at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We're a remote team, but I'm in Barcelona and the company is registered as a Spanish company.
Right. And before, I believe you've done business in Germany as well, right?
Germany and Australia, yeah. My first business was in Australia, and then my second business started in Germany, but I moved it with me to Spain.
I'm very curious how business differs in all of these countries. What are some of the pros and cons that you found, let's say, in Germany that you didn't find in Spain? For people who might be listening to us from, let's say, the United States and thinking of moving their business to Europe, what are some kind of insights that you can share?
First of all, in every country, I believe business people complain about how difficult it is to do business there. Everybody thinks there is particularly hard in their country. Of the three I've done business in, Spain is the hardest by far, much harder than Germany. I sometimes actually regret having moved the business to Spain, but unfortunately it's the nature of the tax rules here that if you're 100% owner of a company, it doesn't matter where in the world that company is, the Spanish government considers that it's in Spain, in which the company must be paying tax and you must be paying tax, etc. It's a bit more complicated than that. Of course, I'm not a tax advisor, etc., so I have to make that disclaimer. But often I wish I could have the company running in a country in which it's a little bit less paperwork and a little bit less confusion in the rules of running a business.
Is that how it was in Australia?
Australia was much easier. Now, I'm from New Zealand originally, but I also spent a lot of time growing up in Australia. So it's a place in which I understand the system much better. It's also in my native tongue. And I did find it much, much easier to run a company in Australia. The rules were clearer. There was much less paperwork. It was almost like the government wanted to keep things simple and make things simple, despite what Australians often seem to think. Again, that comes back to everybody thinking it's hard in their country. But having to compare the three, it was much easier in Australia.
That's what I had imagined. I'm going to jump somewhere else, and it may sound like I'm jumping all over the place, but I thought it'd be interesting to give like a colorful kind of portrait of you as an entrepreneur, not just focus on the beginner story, but also what it's like to run a podcast, amongst other things.
Okay.
You're a SaaS founder who has been running a podcast for quite some time now. You've done over 100 interviews yourself. And I'm curious, besides interesting conversation, what benefits of having a podcast, you know, have you experienced and maybe not anticipated?
I ask myself that often. Every time I click the start recording button, I ask myself, why am I doing this again? I didn't actually start doing this podcast with any real aim except just to practice my ability to speak publicly and to meet up with other interesting people. I had no real business aims. But what I have found is that it's opened doors. Just the fact that I regularly publish episodes of me talking about business creates a kind of authority that I find quite odd. I still have the same half-baked ideas I had when I didn't have a podcast. But just by getting on a microphone and recording it and publishing it regularly, people start giving me more authority. It's really odd. friends I have who have been running businesses longer than me and who I think do a better job than me and know more about business than me now ask me for advice personally, privately. The way we automatically give more authority or more weight to the words of somebody just because they have some type of medium in which they publish it, especially podcasting, in which you don't need anybody's permission to do it, right? It's completely free. There's nobody out there saying, oh, well, first of all, you have to pass this test before we let you publish podcast episodes. It's just me recording them and publishing them.
But the moment you publish it, you make yourself accountable, which I think is what builds authority. Somebody's willing to put that stuff out there, be accountable for it by their audience, and therefore, you know, probably knows what they're talking about.
So I have this fear that somebody will go back and listen to every single podcast recording I've ever done and will carefully make notes looking for all the times in which Steve contradicted himself. But in episode 123, you said this, whereas in episode 192, you said the opposite. My thinking certainly has developed as my business has grown and as I've had more of these interviews. And I think, for example, we talked about the enterprise plans, and that's certainly something I didn't want at the beginning, but that's changed. And I think the podcast captures that somewhat. Hey, another thing the podcast has opened for me is that other people who have a lot of business experience, particularly in specific fields, are open to me contacting them and just saying, hey, can you help me with this problem I'm having? And to them, I'm not a stranger contacting them. I'm the guy with that bootstrapped podcast that they know of contacting them. So this already this way that I'm kind of introduced to people. And some of the people who have followed me personally on Twitter because of the podcast, I mean, these are people like way bigger business with multi-million-dollar businesses with massive followings of their own. And I get a little bit of pleasure from that every time something like that happens, to think, huh, just because I'm willing to be a loudmouth once every couple of weeks, this person who I really look up to is following me.
I like that. So a great networking tool.
Oh,
on top of being, connecting. And you haven't talked about it as a marketing tool at all, but I assume it does kind of help you market Feature Upvote in a way?
I think not. I thought subconsciously or consciously at the beginning that would be a benefit, but I've discovered that the listeners of the podcast, or who we aim for, bootstrap software companies, are typically not the people who have the need for a product like Feature Upvote. There are a few people, who do use it, but not the numbers that will change the business. And we need to get a certain number of new customers each month just to keep revenue steady, and even more if we want to grow. And you don't get that by picking up a customer here or there. You need repeatable sales channels of the people who are your ideal customer. And as we've learned along the way, that's for us as product managers, usually at larger organizations, larger than a small, tiny bootstrap software company. So I don't think it's actually helped much in getting new business. Maybe there's a listener or two who disagrees. I think occasionally a listener will recommend us to somebody else who might be in that target audience, who wouldn't be a podcast listener themselves.
Steve, we're reaching our time here, but if you're up for it, I'd love to ask you a couple of rapid-fire questions where I'm just going to ask you to answer from the top of your head, whatever answer comes to mind. And if it triggers an interesting answer, then maybe we'll use that for maybe a part two episode at some point in time. And if not, then, you know, we'll just move on.
Sure.
So number one, what is the most worthwhile or best investment you've made for your business to date?
Oh, that's an easy one, Ben. Before the business was really sustainable, before it was earning much money at all, I hired a content person. Regular listeners of the podcast will have heard about this story a lot. At the time, I was pretty much putting all the revenue of the business into paying for the content person. And I realized that I was bored with the writing content myself, and therefore it was ceasing to happen. And that was a real problem when, you know, the main marketing channel was content. So I paid for somebody who knew what she was doing and went about it professionally and delivered new good content every month.
Awesome. And we do have a blog post on featureupvote.com that talks about that story and how it helped you grow in 2018. And I think we can link to that in the show notes for
awesome.
Listeners.
Let's do it.
When you think of the word successful, what or who comes to mind and why?
So there's a guy called Andy Bryce. He actually did a guest episode on this podcast a few weeks ago with Robin Warren. Andy has often quoted this the saying from Bob Dylan, Let's see if I can get it right. A man is a success, or a woman, excuse the sexist language, a person is a success if, when they wake up in the morning, they can spend the day doing whatever they want to do. Something like that. Now, Andy has a one-person business. Well, I'd say two-person because I know his wife helps with some of the administrative stuff. And he's been doing this for longer than me. And he's never wanted to employ people. He's never wanted to grow it beyond something he can manage himself. He does everything in the business, support, development, marketing, sales. I have always admired that he's always known that he just wants it to be a one-ish person show and that he's stuck to that over, it must be 15 years or more that he's been doing it.
What is the worst advice you see or hear being dispensed in the world or in business?
Oh, this one I see on Twitter. It's a lot of hard work, they say, to start a SaaS. You start multiple products. You do multiple things at the same time because then you've got more chance of success. Wrong, wrong, wrong. It takes a lot of work and a lot of focus and a lot of grinding on the same thing day after day, month after month. So if you've got one product that's starting to get a little bit of traction, you just have to do that one. Doing another product is just a distraction and will increase the chance of both products failing.
And lastly, what is something you believe others think is insane or strange?
I think it's going back to something I mentioned earlier. It's that I don't need to grow the business quickly. I remember saying this at a founder's lunch once. If my business is growing at more than 10% month after month, I'd be unhappy with that. I want it to be growing less than 10% because 10% per month means that you double every 8 months with the compounding effect. And that means double the number of customers, double the amount of support, double the amount of server problems, perhaps. And just as you're dealing with those problems, the next 8 months have happened and everything's doubled again. And you're forever in this battle to put out fires, to deal with everything doubling. And I don't want that. I don't aim for that. I just want things to be slow and steady. And I think that some other business founders were really surprised to hear and couldn't really understand that mindset of not wanting to grow quickly.
Yet being sustainable and growing.
Yeah. Sustainable here doesn't mean sustainable for the planet. I mean, of course, that's a good thing, but sustainable here means something we can sustain emotionally, psychologically, and with a lifestyle. This is what I mean by sustainable in business, that it's just that we can keep running it without losing it.
Which goes back to your definition of success, being able to wake up, you know, when you want, whenever you want, and do what you want, which is, I really like that definition.
Yeah.
Steve, this conversation has been a lot of fun for me. I got to pick your brains on a lot of topics that I was curious about, and I hope it's helpful to everybody listening. I want to wrap up with one final question. Let people know what Future of Vote is up to in 2023 and your vision for beyond.
Well, that, Ben, would be an entire other podcast episode to explain. But typically for Feature Up Vote, I just want each year to be like the previous year, but a little bit better. You know, a little bit less stress, a little bit better in our processes, a little bit more revenue. It's always good to have a little bit more revenue. It enables everything else. And that's the short answer, but the long answer would be an entire episode.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be a guest on my own podcast.
You were a good one.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.